There is this thing. Do you realize what is? There is this thing. Do you realize
consciousness is affected?
There is this thing
on.
There is this thing going on. Do you realize
our consciousness is affected?
There is this thing going on.
What is called
the news brought to you live.
Welcome to the Friday edition of CKUT's Community News Program, Off the Hour. Today is Friday, July 8th. My name is Alice Wu, and I will be your host today. CKUT broadcasts from the unceded traditional territory of the Anishinaabeg and the Ganyangahaga, one of the founding nations of the Haudenosaunee Confederacy. Stay tuned, we'll be right back. Are you a tenant in Montreal? Do you have questions about your rights? Your local housing committee can help. To find the housing committee for your neighborhood or for more resources, go to www.rclalq.qc.ca. First, news. Quebec has entered the seventh wave of the COVID-19 pandemic, according to Public Health Director Luc Boileau. Last month, the province saw a 50% jump in COVID-19 patients in hospitals, up now to 1,500. This would be the first wave Quebec has experienced after removing almost all public health restrictions. And nearly 500 housing units across Montreal are empty because they are undergoing renovations. This is in the midst of a housing crisis that, as of July 2nd, left 118 households in the city without a home. And on Wednesday, workers for the nonprofit blood collection agency EMA Québec went on strike. They included nurses, nursing assistants, technicians, and counselors. The agency held all scheduled blood drives despite the strike. And the North American Irish Dance Championships took place in Montreal last week at the Palais des Congrès. The event attracted nearly 4,000 competitors who were trying to qualify for the World Championships. And now for some international headlines. Last night, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe was shot at an election campaign rally in the city of Nara, dying 5 hours later. A 41-year-old man allegedly shot Abe using a handmade weapon. This suspect is in custody. And on Thursday, Boris Johnson resigned as Prime Minister of the United Kingdom and head of the Conservative Party. This follows a wave of resignations by other party members. Britain's next Prime Minister will be selected by dues-paying members of the Conservative Party. And on Thursday night, rebels from the Uganda-based Allied Democratic Forces allegedly carried out an attack in Lome in the Democratic Republic of Congo, killing 13 people. This includes infants and patients. The medical center and several homes were set on fire. The reasons for the attack remain unclear. And since mid-June, 77 people across Pakistan, including women and children, have died in rain-related incidents. Monsoon rains have also caused damage to homes, highways, bridges, and power plants across the nation. Minister Sherry Rahman attributed these heavier rains to climate change.
There's a lot going on in the world today. See how it affects Montreal's Black and Caribbean community. Read the Community Contact. News, features, opinions, music reviews, cultural events, and so much more. Our voices, our perspectives, our community. Published every 2 weeks, pick it up at your favorite community spot or visit us online at our new and dynamic website, mtlcommunitycontact.com. Easy to navigate and lots to enjoy. Archived issues also on the site and available on the web. That's mtlcommunitycontact.com. Stay in contact.
Welcome back to CKUT's Friday Off the Hour. The time is just after 5. My name is Alice Wu. Up first on this episode of Off the Hour, we'll be sharing the air with the Coffee with Comrades podcast. This episode discusses why the term climate change doesn't convey enough ecological urgency. It also discusses why focusing too much on fossil fuels may be a mistake.
Welcome to this week's edition of Coffee with Comrades, a podcast discussing culture, current events, theory, and action through a radical lens. Hello and welcome to another edition of Coffee with Comrades. I'm your host, Pearson, and I'm very excited today to share a conversation with you that I had with Peter Gelderloo, author of the new book, The Solutions Are Already Here, available now through Pluto Press. But before we dive in, I have a handful of quick points to get through first. Longtime listeners of the show will know by now that Coffee with Comrades is a proud part of the Channel Zero Network. Check out this jingle from some of our homies to find out more.
We will never ever surrender or compromise. We occupied government buildings, we blockaded highways, and we talked about not just marching, but direct action to shut this shit down.
Here we draw the line. Right here we say no more.
Yat'e, we invite you to join us for Indigenous Action, a podcast where we dig deep into critical issues impacting our communities in the occupied lands known as the so-called United States, or what many people recognize as Turtle Island.
This is an autonomous, anti-colonial broadcast with unapologetic and claws-out analysis towards total liberation.
So take your seat by this fire, and may the bridges we burn together light our way.
Feel that fire so it's a blazing, blazing fire that they can never stop.
Find us at indigenousaction.org and with the Channel Zero Network.
If this is your first time checking out Coffee with Comrades, thanks so much for being here. Like most DIY independent podcasts these days, Coffee with Comrades is on Patreon. If you'd like to support our work and help us continue to facilitate dialogues with rad folks like Peter, I'd encourage you to visit www.patreon.com/coffeewithcomrades and sign up today to become a sustaining member of the program for just $1 a month. The money we raise each month goes directly to supporting this program and keeping us on air for years to come. We're so deeply grateful for the incredible folks who have chosen to support this show. I'm especially thankful for the community that's come up around this program and for the chance to meet and befriend so many phenomenal folks. All that said, I know a lot of people who tune into leftist media aren't exactly flush with cash. If you're not in a financial position to support Coffee with Comrades, that's totally fine. If you still want to see our show grow, I have good news for you. There are a ton of ways that you can help us out. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram, like, share, and retweet our new episode announcements, or leave a review for us on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. The biggest way you can support this show is just by sharing it with a friend or a comrade today. We don't pay to advertise this program, and we don't accept advertisements from third parties, so word of mouth is really the only way a show like ours can grow. Alright, that's my pitch. I'll shut up and get out of your way now. It brings me great pleasure to introduce episode 164 of Coffee with Comrades, Thriving in the Ruins, featuring Peter Gelderloo. Wanted to ask you about the most recent update to the IPCC report because it's gotten even more dire and it's looking real bleak. And so I was just curious about kind of your reaction to the latest reports from the IPCC and kind of their very damning proclamation that we have about 3 years before we can avoid like the worst climate disasters imaginable.
Yeah. I mean, it's depressing. It's a reflection of how, on the whole, scientific institutions have tended towards it being more conservative in their predictions. And I think that's something that's like somewhat like structurally worked into the system. Which is not, that's not a condemnation of the scientific method. It's just that they've tended pretty consistently to be too optimistic in their predictions, even though like the predictions end up having a lot of accuracy, just on a more accelerated timeline, and that's really depressing. And it's more evidence that we shouldn't be relying on the institutions of power to save us from this. It's more evidence that their approach of trying to provide information for governmental institutions and the broader NGO corporate complex is naive. And it's interesting, like they put a lot of research into climate systems and just the thermodynamics of an entire planet and like how temperature is distributed and all of that, and they don't put any research into what are the mechanisms for changing this. They just swallow whole all of this superstition about governments being there for our benefit and corporations even being able to make certain changes, and it's just a fatal lack of seriousness.
Yeah, I've always found that the IPCC reports tend to like. And maybe it's because they're trying to appear scientific and objective, but they lack that like critical invective of like, this is a political dilemma. Like it's like it is an ecological crisis, absolutely, but it is 1000% also a social crisis, a political crisis. And the lack of that has always struck me as maybe less effective and ineffectual than if they tried to offer insight. And now, it probably would end up being pretty banal what they called for, but the total lack of it, right, has always seemed kind of off to me, that there's not even like the slightest
you know, like serious consideration of how power operates in the world. And it's a little bit dispiriting as well to add to the just heaping pile of depression of just like the sheer terror of what's going on right now.
Yeah.
it's not great. It's not great. Well, on that powerful, depressing note, I am very pleased to welcome Peter Gelderloo, the anarchist movement participant and author of the new book, The Solutions Are Already Here, to Coffee with Comrades. Welcome on the program, Peter. It's so good to be with you today.
Thanks a lot for inviting me. Thanks for reading the book and sharing a lot of critical thoughts about it.
For sure. I'm always happy to do so. You know, I know you've written a number of books over the years, including How Nonviolence Protects the State, which I personally credit as one of the texts that helps kind of dissolve the last lingering remnants of a kind of a dogmatic like approach to nonviolence. So I appreciate that. I just wondered briefly if you could tell me about your relationship to egalitarian struggles and let listeners know how you got engaged in revolutionary movements and organizing.
I grew up in a part of the U.S. and a moment in which the existence of social struggles had really been disappeared, and so there were not in my area there weren't any social movements, any radical social movements to actually get involved in. So for me, like, the hostilities really started in a very informal way with, you know, for example, capitalist architecture and you know, forms of authoritarianism that are experienced in a more day-to-day basis. Just very much like individual or small group responses. And then I finally was able to, you know, discover and connect with, radical anti-capitalist social movements in you know, the anti-globalization era after after Seattle 99, and then, you know, with the anti-war movement and you know, continuing on from there. So it took a while, and I'm very glad that, you know, now we live in a world where in most parts of the world, like, it's the social peace has been completely ruptured, and everywhere there are people struggling, and, you know, you don't have to feel like completely alone if you just feel like the entire world is like, you know,
off.
Place where survival is not really possible.
Yeah, totally. It's kind of a mixed bag in that regard. Like, on the one hand, like, you know, the sobering reckoning with the reality of our shared epoch, but also the fact that you can find some camaraderie and some affinity with other people who have similar convictions about how we need to change the world. For folks who've never heard of The Solutions Are Already Here, could you speak a little bit about the overarching thesis of the book? Like, how would you explain it to somebody over a cup of coffee?
I would say that it has maybe three basic parts. The first is that all of the mainstream ways of understanding and responding to the ecological crisis are actually parts of the problem. They are actually reflections of what's wrong and ways of reproducing and continuing what's wrong. And secondly, that in fact, there are already a lot of very effective, very radical, very important struggles that get right to the heart of the problem that are actually accomplishing things, and that if struggles were to get more support and to be spread around the world and to every territory, then we would have the best possible chance, all of us, as many as possible, of surviving this ecological crisis. And then the final part is trying to tease out some of the unifying characteristics of these very often disparate and certainly heterogeneous struggles. For example, being territorial, and that's, so I live in Catalonia, and so in my day-to-day I'm often speaking more Spanish and Catalan, and so that's, I would ask people to, like, not take that with, like, the English connotation that territorial has, as in, like, you know, possessive, as in, you know, drawing lines around the earth and saying, you know, this belongs to me, not to you. Although maybe possessive in a more, you know, satanic sense. getting really, really
hell yeah,
connected to a territory, or, you know, you like letting yourself be like taken over by a territory. So putting your roots down in, you know, not just like the earth in an abstract, you know, like that big old blue ball, you know, floating in space, courtesy of NASA, but like specific land that you can have like a specific relationship with, that you, that, you know, you really like sink your roots into and are transformed by and transform in turn. So they're territorial and localized. They, you know, have a penchant for direct action and self-organization. They network, and they're very, very specific to, you know, to like the, how they experience the crisis locally, and also to, you know, what the ecosystem is locally. So they're ecological rather than economic, I think you could say.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I love the idea of becoming rooted in a place in space. It's very rhizomatic. I'm a big fan of Deleuze and his rhizomes. So I love that image. I wanted to ask you about, you know, the crisis that we are in, because a lot of people have a lot of different words for it. You know, a lot of mainstream academics will refer to the era that we're in as the Anthropocene, where human beings are having an effect on the climate. Other people prefer the term Capitalocene, which places blame more squarely on capital and the economy and its extractive powers, particularly with regard to fossil fuels. And then there's people like Donna Haraway, who contends that a more apt term is the Cthulhucene, in which these kind of interstitial relationships between all the different organisms and the planet itself are evolving and changing and redeveloping and reconstituting themselves in myriad ways. And I was wondering, in your view, which of these terms best describes our current crisis, if any, right? Like, are any of these apt for describing where we're at, or would you offer a different type of insight into this era of collapse and crisis in which we find ourselves?
Yes. Yeah, so I'll start with the Anthropocene. The Anthropocene, we can sort of imagine, I don't know, some you know, professor's office in an important university somewhere, or maybe even, you know, the cliched smoky drawing room of, you know, some very well-meaning and just horribly misguided, like, older white folks saying, like, you know, we need to take this thing seriously, by golly, like, you know, this we've done so much damage to the planet that, you know, that, you know, it's like, I mean, it's saying that, like, the current geological eras, like a new geological era is you know, named. It's like, it's, you know, they're divided up. These are often like, you know, chunks of time that, you know, last for like tens of millions of years. Like, that's like, right. Like such a huge change in the history of the planet that it's like recorded in the very rock layers. So that's a very big deal. So trying to say like that this, you know, this problem, which they reduce to climate change, is such a big deal that, you know, that it deserves being named as like a new geological era. So it's the geological era defined by human beings, and just, oh, it's like, yeah, key the buzzer sound, like, so, like, wrong. Like, this problem was not caused by humans. Humans have been around for a long time, and this problem has not been around for a long time. And this problem is not, it's not an inevitable byproduct of Homo sapiens. It's not created equally by all humans. And in fact, a great many humans have died trying to stop this problem from, you know, being turned into a global system. So it's just, I mean, you know, accidentally, but still just so racist, so colonial, and just so it's just like the old move of defining Western European civilization as, you know, the, like, that's like, you know, coterminal with humanity.
Right.
And so that's just such a huge problem. So no, that one is out the window, defenestrated. Okay, I'm going to get maybe obnoxiously picky about Capitalocene and Cthulhucene. I just really don't like, I mean, when, like, you know, like, you, a lot of these words, these scientific words are, like, built up using, like, you know, Greek prefixes and suffixes. And when you just, like, take, like, a, I don't know, like, modern English word and, like, tack it in there, that just feels tacky to me. Although, you know, I have, like, so, okay. Probably a more cogent point is that Capitalocene is very easy to understand, and it's pretty close to being on the money. And then Cthulhucene, probably the more important point, is, like, you know, the theoretical jaunt that Donna Haraway takes to explain that term, which is, you know, very, like, useful and interesting and illuminating. So in the book, when I'm criticizing Anthropocene, I say that, and I'm talking about like different attempts to explain in like a grand narrative, like, you know, what is this problem? Where does it come from? I suggest Cratocene, which would be the geological era defined by the state, you know, with, you know, proper use of Greek prefixes. But again, at this point, there's just like too many horses in that race. So I'm not
right, married to it.
In any kind of like campaign to like actually convince people to this. Sure. But I do want to convince people that like if we need a grand narrative for, you know, what's the problem and where it's coming from. So, okay, like, you know, you have some, you know, some very, you know, sensitive, you know, pundits and academics, like, you know, whose feelings are hurt when all the blame is put on Western civilization, because it is true that, you know, some ecosystem collapses have been caused by some societies out there that haven't been Western civilization. None of them anywhere near on the scale of what we're facing, thanks to global capitalism. But it is nonetheless true that if we get rid of capitalism and we, you know, abolish Western civilization, there's still an imaginable future in which, you know, we'll suffer ecological collapses. So, you know, if we really, even though, you know, again, like the difference of scale here means that that is usually not a sincere objection to, you know, placing the blame on the door of Western civilization. But if we really want to, you know, like get, you know, scoop all the way down and, you know, really like, you know, totally expunge that fucker, what is the characteristic of societies that are not Western societies, that are not like, you know, white dominated societies that have caused those much, much smaller ecological collapses. Some scholars have tried to, again, bring it back to the human species by talking about extinctions caused by, you know, like early hunter-gatherers. And I think that's extremely erroneous because it is completely lacking in any systemic analysis. Any new species, especially a species that tends to become like a sort of apex species in most ecosystems that it enters, is likely to cause some extinctions. You know, because like that's how extinctions work. That's totally how evolution. Like, yeah. Extinction is a part of evolution. There's a qualitative difference between an ecosystem collapse and extinctions that number in the dozens, right, over like a very, very long period of time.
Right.
So I think that's just like not the way to look at it. So all of the human societies that have caused the ecosystem collapse, as far as we know, have either been statist societies or societies that are very much advancing towards having more concentrated, intense hierarchies, and so moving towards being statist societies. So I think we can fairly and most accurately say that state formation or statism causes ecological collapse, and that capitalism subsequently provides an engine that makes states more effective at war making, more effective at social control, spreading their domination, and that gives them the possibility of creating a world system which takes ecological collapse up to a new qualitative level.
Yeah, that's pretty comprehensive, and I'm hard pressed to disagree with you. I think that like there's definitely something to be said for the emergence of regimented hierarchies and how those regimentations necessarily reinforce exploitation, oppression, dispossession, which are of course part and parcel to the current crisis that we find ourselves in. And I wondered, you know, one of the big thrusts, especially early in the text that you make, is to try and decouple our understanding of climate collapse and catastrophe from simply looking at the data around carbon emissions. And so why is a fixation on fossil fuels, in your estimation, the wrong focus for our collective struggles?
Yeah, and I would even say that I think it's better to talk about ecological crisis rather than climate crisis, even though obviously the climate crisis is a major part of that. It's multifaceted. There are, you know, various interconnected systems that are in crisis, the climate being one of those. Climate crisis enables this sort of reductionist technocratic focus on carbon emissions, because obviously carbon and methane emissions are the number one driver of climate change. And that is part and parcel of living in a technocratic world order, which is that's how scientific capitalism is managed nowadays. So that way of managing the crisis is another aspect of the very global system that causes the crisis. So on the one hand, we have technocratically managed corporate industries around the world that are extractivist, that are destructive, that are ecocidal, that are genocidal. And then on the other hand, we have technocratic scientific institutions that have completely subsumed a colonial white supremacist way of viewing the world, and that coincidentally respond to a multifaceted crisis by reducing it to the simple question of what fuels are powering this society. If you look at it like that, then you can simply bring in new fuels, bring in new inputs, and supposedly solve the problem without dismantling that society. Green capitalism, exactly. It's also not a coincidence. I don't have, any means here where I live of, testing how many parts per million of carbon dioxide we got, in the air today. I'm guessing that you don't either, do you?
Nope, can't say that I do.
So that's, pretty wild and crazy that the most important data we're supposed to pay attention to is parts per million carbon dioxide, which is something that none of us can easily test. And yet if you start gardening, or if you start wildcrafting, taking care of the forest or the estuary where you live, and blending your life with it by eating from that web of relations and trying to take care of that web of relations, even within a few years. So I'm talking about growing up alienated, white, like a reproducer of a culture that has, really no remaining memory of how to live in a reciprocal way with other living beings. Even within, a few years of gardening, I can start to experience pretty significant changes to my worldview, to the relationships that I'm a part of, to the information that I have access to, that's already telling me a lot, and rather specifically about changes to the climate, about changes that are affecting other living beings. And I don't need some, like a scientist to come along and validate that for me. And that's not a total rejection of the scientific method of scientifically produced knowledge. I think, that also has its place. But it is an assertion that that's not the only kind of knowledge.
Totally.
And certainly is not the most empowering kind of knowledge. And it's not the kind of knowledge that's crucial to the struggles that I think we'll find are the most effective at dealing with this problem, and that give us the best hope for mutual survival to this crisis. And that's another thing that we can critique about the IPCC report. It's not that we have 3 years left. We're 500 years late. In dealing with this thing. Species have been getting slaughtered, and humans have been getting killed off by the millions, enslaved by the tens of millions for hundreds of years. So it's not a future problem.
Yeah, no, well said. It reminds me, it's bringing up Haraway again, it reminds me of her essay on situated knowledges and how we can look at science through a more feminist lens, and see how knowledge is constituted, and how it has different knowledge bases, right? And how that can be a really beautiful thing and a really empowering thing that often the kind of rigid masculinist forms of the scientific dogma often overlook or neglect. And so I think that you're definitely onto something there. And I think that's really rad. I wanted to ask you, in chapter 3, you talk about moving from cities to habitats. And I was really struck by the idea of it almost felt like you were synthesizing kind of an anti-civ perspective with a kind of communalist perspective, which is not something that I see people do a lot. And so it was refreshing in that regard. And one of the big focuses in that section is just on how fictitious this rural-urban divide is, and how the unique technologies that are different in certain communities can be leveraged to build autonomy and deal with the ecological crisis. It feeds really well into this conversation about situated knowledge and about the different ways that we interact with our specific situated individual kind of communities. And so I wanted to ask you a bit more about that idea, about moving from cities to habitats, and why that was so important for you to highlight in your book.
Well, I guess, especially after we just talked about situated knowledge, it would be a bit hypocritical of me to not also situate myself. So maybe I'll be a little bit more personal. For a number of years, I was living in Barcelona, and which is a really big, dense city, which is fascinating. It can definitely wear you down, like living in a place like that. And you know, also like the world is a pretty hard place to live in. Just as like a sort of like mental health exercise, if I was like feeling depressed, I just like look out my window at like this like ugly little street, and I would just like imagine all of us out there with like pickaxes tearing up the street. And then I'd imagine like a couple years later, when all of the the fruit bearing trees that we had planted, like almond trees and lemon trees and apple trees and the streets that are, going to get more sun on them, like even like orange trees, little paths between them, where bicycles could go, chickens running around, getting just out of the way of the bicycles, like how healthier that would be, like how good that felt to imagine that. And like one of the reasons I was imagining that, also because like if you don't, like too many people come at the problem like they want to drop a big blueprint, and that's like a blueprint is just a huge act of violence, not the good violence either. It's just like I mean, one of the ways that our world is suffering so much is that it's just had extremely powerful institutions imposing blueprints on it for such a long time. And a blueprint is just like a completely disrespectful activity with regards to the territory, with regards to the land. And so like if you're thinking like, okay, here we are in Barcelona or in whatever city, what happens if like capitalism falls apart today and the state tries to, comes in with its, disaster management agencies and tries to manage this, like do we just go along with that, do we obviously we loot the supermarkets, but then what, because the supermarkets, that's not going to last us very long. What things can we do right now that will give us a little bit of a head start, if that happens? Or what if it's not like a complete collapse, but things are getting much more fragile, getting much more scarce as they are now already, what can we do to push it over the edge in a way that, we're not all just like, dying, happy and free, but dead, but like actually like, making a different way of living. And so like kind of looking out the window and like replacing the asphalt with orchards and trees and all that was like, it was both like an exercise in survival, in that moment, moment of depression, powerlessness, sadness and all that. And also an exercise of survival for, that very certain future, which is coming, like, whatever version of disaster it is, probably like, much more slower drawn out disaster than like, any of these like kind of silly zombie fantasies that have been coming out. And I think that's a very necessary exercise of survival that we need to do. And so part of that, getting back to your question, sorry for the kind of thrown out answer.
No, I appreciate it. I think these things are tied together, like being able to recognize like our immediate dispossession and immiseration under capitalism and within these spaces that are intentionally designed to isolate us is necessarily going to be part of getting free in order to recognize the myriad connections that we have to one another, to the earth itself, to the non-human animals that inhabit the earth as well and that we share it with. I think those things are fundamentally tied together. So I don't see it necessarily as a digression, just a deepening of like a very real problem that's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. And it's also like, I think like that perspective that I was trying to like describe is very much like seeing the place we live as our necessary habitat. So it doesn't come from that more like, you know, idealist, like, you know, either like let's like impose a blueprint on the whole world, like, you know, this is the most, you know, ecological way for the entire world civilization to exist, as though one person could possibly formulate that. And it's also not like, you know, well, let's, you know, move into the countryside and like, you know, it's like, you know, where we live right now, like that is our habitat, and we should start treating that as our habitat. And also like, you know, in, you know, one or the other version of collapse, like we're going to have to like make a living, like in the real sense of the word, make our living possible. Where we find ourselves, and you know, there will be a lot of human movement, you know, connected to that. Most areas we're not going to be able to just like abandon to go somewhere else. So that's the one side. Like in cities, we need to make life much more possible, and cities can come a long way towards feeding their inhabitants, and also towards being habitats for a great many other species besides humans. Probably not compatible with cars, but fairly high living density can be compatible with much, much, much more of an ecological way of living than what's currently being practiced. And then the flip side of that, so what, like 7 or so years ago, I moved out of Barcelona to like the outskirts of a small city, much more in the country, like, you know, outside my window, it's like, you know, orchards and mountains and stuff like that. A lot of people who live in the city tend to like think that, you know, capitalism is a city thing, industrialism is a city thing, and that's just so wrong and ignorant. Like the countryside was industrialized a long, long time ago. It is every bit as much industrialized as the city. Many rural spaces are actually more industrialized than plenty of urban neighborhoods. It's just different industries, and with them, different logics of organization are being deployed there. Totally. And then so you have some areas in the countryside that are like partially abandoned by capitalism. So mountainous areas, like, you know, capitalism, the state, they're not very good at, you know, doing mountains or doing, you know, marshlands, like a lot of ecosystems they're just bad at. They're not that competent in. So beyond, you know, these flatlands where you can get like, you know, the mega tractor, like, you know, coming through and you know, harvesting, you know, hectares at a go. You have, you know, more mountainous regions that they're like, okay, well, let's just, you know, plant this with a bunch of like genetically modified pine trees and, you know, maybe come back in 30 years and cut it down and, you know, see what we do with that. Just like, you know, you have abandoned urban areas that, you know, are not ideal sites for capitalist accumulation, because while capitalism is very, very big on integrating people and, you know, all living things as much as possible and exploiting them, all capitalism that currently exists is also racial capitalism. So it's also constantly excluding, you know, the wrong kinds of people. It's excluding racialized people. It's excluding people who don't fit into, you know, this Western white supremacist idea of, you know, what is humanity. And so in those more excluded parts of the urban landscape, it's also, you know, relegated to, you know, sort of like, kind of lower down the hierarchy forms of extractivism, like you know, like kind of like, you know, poverty targeting economies. So, you know, there's no territory that's completely abandoned by capitalism. There are territories that capitalism has, you know, a harder time with because of one form of exclusion or another, but it still carries out, you know, some kind of extractivism there. And every inch of the landscape is industrialized. So there's just like there's a lot of work to do in turning a city into a habitat. There's a hell of a lot of work to do in turning the countryside into a habitat, or turning, you know, what people nowadays refer to as a forest, and is more often either a tree plantation or, you know, a natural amusement park, into like an actual forest, an actual thriving ecosystem.
One of the things I really appreciated about the solutions already here, kind of pivoting and looking at those solutions, since we've kind of addressed some of the overarching problems, is its internationalist perspective. You've got interviews in here with folks from all over the place, in Brazil, Indonesia, France, and Catalonia, and more. And obviously, it goes without saying that an epochal struggle against ecological collapse is necessarily going to be global in its orientation. But the thing is, you've done a really lovely job of like actually demonstrating that in the text with these different folks who are have their unique and situated experiences. And so I was wondering just about like kind of how you managed to pull that all together, right? Like how were you able to network with these different communities? What were the connections that you were able to cultivate and to bring to bear and to bring to fruition in order to help make this book come into being?
It was absolutely a collective work. It's not on me. It's a result or a fruition of decades of international solidarity, of struggles in one place being curious about and making contacts with struggles in another place, about people who travel like illegally, flaunting borders, you know, being able to travel from the global south and break through, you know, the walls of Fortress Europe or you know the walls of the U.S. border and you know get to places, you know, for example, you know, where I might live so that, you know, we could get to know each other and, you know, start friendships and relationships of solidarity, or conversely, people from the global north, you know, who have citizenship privileges, instead of, you know, traveling like revolutionary tourists, like we're meant to do, actually like traveling, you know, through like solidarity projects where we try to bring resources to bear, where we try to like help create international relationships, you know, between, you know, our scenes in different countries. And so basically I just asked for help. I just asked for contacts, help with translations. Of course I was able to do the interviews in Spanish and Catalan, but I had a great deal of help, folks who conducted interviews in French or in Brazilian Portuguese, or who did, you know, translations from Indonesian, from other languages. The fact that, you know, we have like a movement security infrastructure that allows for fairly secure communications so that people who are faced with, you know, pretty dangerous governmental security apparatus who, you know, who are fighting to protect forests or, you know, who are, you know, members of indigenous communities that are fighting against ongoing colonialism and who are getting criminalized for what they're doing, are able to talk about those struggles in, you know, in an anonymous and secure way. So like a number of the interviews that folks did for the book are anonymous and, you know, took place with like secure communications. And, you know, that's thanks to like, you know, like the, you know, radical techno geeks who set that infrastructure and, you know, those tools up for us. So it's been completely a collective project. I also want to say that in recognition of that, like all of the money from the book that would normally go to the author is going to comrades, to projects in Brazil and in Indonesia who helped out with the book. And I want to say that in large part as a challenge to other people, other radicals who write. Especially if it's writing about social movements or writing, you know, that which is, you know, in the end, just kind of putting knowledge on a page when it's knowledge that comes from social movements, that comes from these collective processes and struggles, that maybe folks should think about whether they should be the ones to get the money from that. And I know it's hard. None of us can pay a lot of us can't pay the rent. And that really sucks. And, you know, it also, like, you know, folks out there who have, like, you know, like a trust fund or whatever are, like, in a unique position to be able to, like, find time for writing. And otherwise it's, like, very tough, hard to, like, you know, how do you get the resources and, like, find the time for writing? It would be really nice if our movement could get better at, like, breaking this kind of ridiculous author culture that, like, sees, like, the authorship of books as, like, a purely individual act. And you know, also puts authors on this pedestal, which is like, you know, both like stupid and damaging, and you know, takes more collective ownership over, you know, these processes of like, how do we do theory and whatnot. And, you know, that also means like, you know, like that goes in both ways.
Totally.
And, but, you know, at the very least, like, you know, it would be good if, you know, we were like more real in our recognitions of like, you know, where is this knowledge actually coming from? Cause it's not, this book would have been a hollow shell if, you know, if it hadn't been for like that very, very rich network of international solidarity. Cause yeah, like, for folks who haven't read it yet, the biggest chapter is chapter 3, and that's almost all interviews with comrades and struggles around the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful and well said, and I think a good call to collective action. And on the note of anti-colonial and decolonial struggles, I wanted to talk a little bit about how people who are racialized, especially indigenous people, have been time and time again leading the fight against capitalist production and exploitation and ecological collapse and ecological crisis. And I wondered if you could maybe talk about, I don't know, one or two examples of how those struggles are a guiding light in this fight against capital, against hierarchy, and against the many forces at play in the world today that are beset upon profit over people.
Yeah. So basically, I think some important like factors there to start it off, because indigenous struggles have been the most effective at stopping a lot of these mega projects that are like, you know, the specific material instances in which this world devouring machine is expanding itself. They've been the most, like, indigenous communities are, you know, bear the most responsibility for protecting the world's remaining biodiversity. And also, you know, like, kind of definitionally, indigenous communities are the ones that have access to ancestral technologies or ancestral forms of knowledge that are the specific ways that we can actually survive relationally, reciprocally.
Reciprocally. Something like that. I know what you're talking about.
That we can survive relationally and reciprocally with the rest of the living world. And whiteness kind of definitionally is having that knowledge completely erased and sort of, you know, orienting towards the knowledge produced by capitalism. And, you know, of course, you know, through, you know, various historical coincidences, fitting, you know, being included in like, you know, the images of, you know, what civilized humanity is supposed to look like. So, you know, if we talk about like technologies in that sense, like it's not, you know, kind of gadget that you can, you know, buy on Amazon. It's something that's completely situated, completely rooted. It's, you know, it's something that's going to work in one specific part of the world in relation with other species, with other living beings and so on. Some specific examples, for example, in the book, I include an interview that a Brazilian anarchist comrade did with a, there's this tandem project between some Guarani communities that are in the process of recovering their land, and I'll talk about that more in a second, with Brazilian anarchists who, mostly racialized anarchists who have left the city and have these, you know, more rural projects close to some of these Guarani communities, and that are able to establish like this reciprocal and solidaristic relationship, you know, having access, you know, everyone kind of brings something else to the table and, you know, access to different resources and all that. So a lot of the lands of these Guarani communities have been damaged by colonialism for a very, very, very long time. And so a lot of what they have to do is really just starting from the ground up, like healing the soil so that it can actually, you know, it can actually grow things just after, you know, so long of like an extractivist economy and monocropping and all of that. And so it's, you know, it's a very, very real experience of land back, like physically being able to retake the land, and then through these different traditional knowledge systems that also have to be adapted over time, healing the land, and then combining the concerns of food sovereignty or food autonomy, you know, being able to feed themselves, which is absolutely necessary to survival, and to being able to fight back against and destroy racial capitalism by not, you know, being dependent on it to feed them, with helping, you know, other and more diverse ecosystems to recover. Because a lot of times these sort of like green capitalists together with like the sort of, you know, NGO environmentalists or like Extinction Rebellion style, you know, impose a blueprint on the world, or like, you know, Andreas Malm sort of a colonial environmentalists, they are very effective at playing off the needs of food sovereignty or food autonomy against the needs of reforestation. Is a great one. What the hell does reforestation mean? Like, you know, if you look at some of the work of, like, you know, E.P. Thompson and stuff like that, you find that forestation, you know, that word used as such was actually originally used to describe a process of stealing the land, you know, from the commons, from the peasants, and holding it as state-controlled lands, which were basically tree plantations for example, building warships for the state. Stuff like that. Nowadays, we can find great examples where where a lot of Mapuche comrades are also involved in a process of winning their land back. And one of the most important anti-colonial activities that they have to do, and ecological activities that they have to do, actually involves like cutting trees down, because the trees that we're dealing with are, you know, imported and often, or like exotic and often genetically modified eucalyptus and pine, which were planted originally by the Pinochet regime as a way of occupying Mapuche lands and, you know, industrializing that that part of the countryside, with, you know, like a forestry industry. And so, you know, Chile now gets to pass itself off as, you know, one of these carbon negative countries that can sell carbon credits to, you know, to European or North American countries, companies, et cetera, because they have this extremely ecologically destructive forestry industry that depletes the soil, depletes the water table, and forcibly occupies, destroys biodiversity. Like these are, you know, they're called forests. They're deserts if they're measured in terms of biodiversity.
Welcome back to Off the Hour on CKUT 90.3 FM. You were just listening to an episode of the Coffee with Comrades podcast. If you'd like to hear the rest, visit coffeewithcomrades.com and look for episode 164. Before we go, here's some news you can use. Indigenous Fridays are returning to Cabot Square this summer. These events explore Indigenous art and culture and raise awareness on homelessness in Montreal's Indigenous communities. That's every Friday until August 19th from 1 to 4 p.m. You can find out more on the Cabot Square Project Facebook page. And the Lotus Festival is taking place this weekend. It'll be celebrating creativity by Asian and queer artists in the city through performances, workshops, and artworks. The festival will take place from today until Sunday. You can find out more on the Facebook page, The Lotus Festival. And the Montreal Street Food Festival is ongoing at the Old Port. It celebrates Montreal's diverse food culture, from Asian to South American. You can find the schedule on the website oldportofmontreal.com under the Food Festival section. And the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute is having a webinar in support of McGill students in solidarity with Palestine. They'll have Pink Floyd's guitarist, Roger Waters, as a special guest speaker. That's next Thursday on July 14th. You can find out more about the event at the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute's Facebook page. And that concludes this Friday's edition of Off the Hour, produced by Montreal's Community News Collective. The collective includes Brian Jefferson, Alice Wu, Joel Somadol, Killian Davenport-Brown, Tess Pilkington, Pranjal Malik, Moisha Mori, Ree Miraji, Michael Edelson, and Sarah Jesmer. For more information on anything you heard tonight, or if you would like to participate or support news produced by and for the Montreal community, please contact CKUT's Community News Department at 514-448-4041, extension 2593, or email newsintern@ckut.ca. Also, you can follow us on Instagram at OffTheHourMTL, or connect with us on Facebook. Search for CKUT. Stay tuned for Cafe, coming up next.